I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's The Takeaway for Monday, May 13th. Conservative states like Georgia are renewing their push to restrict abortion rights.
I realize that some may challenge it in the court of law, but our job is to do what is right. We will always continue to fight for life.
We want to know about the medical and legal consequences of the recent restrictions to abortion. Also on the show, I'll talk to longtime Middle East reporter Anne Bernard about how Syria used a program of incarceration and torture to crush civilian opposition.
Merely participating in a protest or even liking a Facebook post about a protest could land you into this system.
And the latest in the Trump administration's push to remake the asylum process is making some asylum officers uncomfortable.
They feel that they're being asked to do something that they very much worry is inconsistent with international law and with their humanitarian obligations.
But first up, the fight over abortion rights.
All those in favor say aye.
Any opposed?
Motion passes. Committee
Mr.
amendment
Chairman,
is tabled.
Mr. President, there was no motion. There was no motion.
There was a motion. He made a motion.
He didn't even make a motion, Mr. President.
Hold on. Excuse me.
He did not make a motion.
A vote on what would be one of the strictest abortion laws in the nation was tabled last week when a shouting match broke out among lawmakers in the Alabama State House.
In response to the number of abortions performed this year versus the rape and incest.
Mr. President.
He did not make a motion.
The Alabama bill would criminalize abortion in almost all cases and would charge doctors with up to 99 years in prison for providing abortions. Alabama's bill would be the most restrictive, but it's part of a series of efforts across the country to limit abortion. Most of the legislation focuses on the sixth week of pregnancy. That's when many anti-abortion rights activists argue that a heartbeat emerges in the womb. But many medical professionals say that's not true. Here to talk us through the so-called heartbeat bills that have been passed in Ohio, Georgia, and Mississippi, we have two guests. Dr. Jennifer Conti is an OBGYN physician and clinical assistant professor in gynecology at Stanford University, and Mary Ziegler is a law professor at Florida State University. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Dr. Conti, I want to start with you with a clarifying question here. When these laws mention the, quote, heartbeat of a fetus, what exactly are they referring to?
Well, it's a good question, and I think it's important to realize here that there is no medical basis for these laws, specifically this. And the way that they're named is intentionally very confusing and very tricky because these lawmakers are essentially trying to pull at your heartstrings to use a term or something that the general public can relate to that's not necessarily medical language. But the fact of the story is this: it doesn't matter when they essentially ban abortion. By doing it so early, they are effectively outright banning abortion, or at least that's the attempt.
From a medical perspective, though, before we get into the political issues here, what, doctor, do you see as the impact on women of limiting abortions to the first 6 weeks of pregnancy?
Well, I mean, absolutely, without a doubt, myself and my colleagues can assure you, I mean, as an abortion provider, I can tell you that this will hurt women. Most people don't even realize that they're pregnant this early in pregnancy. And that's because when we talk about people's gestational age or how far along they are, it's done based on your last menstrual period. So essentially, the first time that you miss your period or that you could even realize you were pregnant if you were being so vigilant, you're already 4 weeks pregnant. And the fact is, some studies show that upwards of 35% of women don't even have a normal, quote-unquote normal, 28-day cycle. So you're talking about a huge proportion of women who wouldn't even know they were pregnant that early.
Mary, I want to bring you in here because I would love to take a listen to how Georgia Governor Brian Kemp described the six-week abortion bill that he signed into law earlier this month. Let's take a listen.
I'm signing HB 481 this morning to ensure that all Georgians have the opportunity to live, grow, learn, and prosper in our great state. Through the Life Act, we will allow precious babies to grow up and realize their full God-given potential.
Mary, what do you make of Kemp's statement there, and is it similar to how lawmakers are presenting similar bills across the country?
It is. I think the language isn't particularly new in the sense that abortion restrictions going back for decades have been portrayed as, you know, vindicating the rights of unborn children or of newborn babies. I think what's different in part is that lawmakers are willing to go a lot further and don't seem to be as concerned about paying a price politically as they might have been, you know, even 10 years ago. So something has changed, I think, both in terms of the confidence lawmakers have that they're going to win at the Supreme Court, but also I think in their sense that they can prevail at the ballot box, even if the courts don't vindicate what they're doing.
And do we have any sense of what's prompted these laws? We mentioned several bills similar to this have been passed, including in Ohio and in Georgia. Why are we seeing so many similar measures happening right now?
Yeah, it's actually interesting because the group that sort of created a model law for so-called heartbeat laws, a group called Faith to Action, began in 2011. So this isn't a new strategy. What's new, again, is the willingness of legislators to pass these laws. So I think it's two things. The most obvious is that the Supreme Court has changed. So we have two new justices that Donald Trump nominated. And I think abortion opponents believe, I think, that this court will uphold something like a six-week abortion ban. I don't think that's correct. And I think a lot of other anti-abortion groups actually don't agree that that's correct either. There's a pretty deep strategic divide in the movement about this. But I think lawmakers are more willing to take a chance on this Supreme Court. And then I think secondly, Donald Trump has convinced some in the GOP that you can win not by appealing to the middle, but by energizing the base. And I think these bills are kind of a way to do that too. So even if a lot of voters in states like Georgia may not be comfortable with a six-week abortion ban, the ones who are maybe more excited about the issue, more likely to turn out. So I think there's some GOP politicians trying to follow the Trump playbook here.
Speaking with Mary Ziegler, a law professor at Florida State University, and Dr. Jennifer Conte, a professor of gynecology at Stanford University. And we're talking about the potential impact of so-called heartbeat laws on the right to an abortion. Dr. Conte, how do you respond to efforts by Alabama and Georgia state legislators that could criminally charge doctors for providing abortions?
I go back to, again and again, this idea that politicians are not medical experts. I care for women every single day, and I can already, you know, without much effort, think of a handful of women that I recently cared for that this would have affected had they been in a state like this, or had laws like this actually gone into place. One woman that comes to mind is a mother already, two children at home, and she noticed that she was feeling pregnant, so she took a pregnancy test thinking, well, this can't be positive. I have an IUD or intrauterine device in place. And sure enough, it was positive. And it turns out that the IUD had actually perforated or gone through her uterus, which is rare, but we see it happen. And she was pregnant and only about 6.5 weeks before she finally figured this out. So it was not lost on her or myself that had she lived in Georgia or, you know, in a time when this law has actually gone through, she would have been criminalized. I would have been criminalized for essentially helping her when she was doing everything she was supposed to be doing.
I'm wondering, Doctor, also whether or not these laws, if they ultimately take effect, would push women to seek illicit abortions or at-home abortions or other ways to deal with this if they're unable to do it in a medical facility?
You know, it definitely could. I think that we're talking about going back to essentially a time before Roe v. Wade when we do know that women were seeking abortions outside of the medical system. And we look at other countries or studies that have been done in other countries where abortion laws have been more restrictive, like South Africa, Nepal, and you see that when restrictions go up, the maternal mortality, which, you know, these women would fall into because they are pregnant, soars. And the opposite is true in countries where abortion laws are less criminalized or more liberal. Maternal mortality rate decreases and the number of abortions does not increase alongside it.
Mary, I'm wondering, you know, we're looking here at this proposed legislation in Alabama that would make it a felony to provide an abortion after the 6 week of pregnancy. Is there also concern, Mary, in your experience, about women being imprisoned for receiving abortions, not just providers or practitioners, but the women who are in need of this of these services? And I'm thinking of countries that have all-out abortion bans, like Ecuador, for example.
Yeah, I think there are concerns. The anti-abortion movement in the United States, including in states like Alabama and Georgia, has been really clearly and consistently saying that women would not be punished. But I think what you see in countries like Ecuador is that it's almost a zero-sum game for abortion opponents because of the availability of medical abortion. And for that reason, women can get abortion pills on their own, online, and end their own pregnancies. And so if you're not going to criminalize that, there's going to be a pretty big loophole in these criminal laws. So I think there is going to be tremendous pressure on anti-abortion legislators in the states to punish women, because if not, there's going to be a pretty big hole, I think, in the otherwise stringent criminal laws. I think the other, it's kind of a lose-lose proposition, though, because the reason I think abortion opponents are saying that women won't be punished is because it's politically pretty toxic to allow for the punishment of women. So it's one of those things that I think if we're going to be in a post-Roe world, it'll be really kind of puzzling and interesting to see how anti-abortion legislators deal with that issue.
I'm wondering if you, Mary, if you have any sense of how these laws would continue to play out in other states around the country. Would this encourage other states to pass similar legislation?
There's kind of a strategic civil war within the anti-abortion movement right now about whether these laws are the way to go. So some states will certainly continue the momentum, I think in part because there's sort of a, among GOP legislators, a contest to see who has the strongest opposition to abortion. But some of the more sort of establishment anti-abortion groups like the Susan B. Anthony List or Americans United for Life think that these are kind of foolhardy bills, because they don't think that there are yet 5 votes or potentially even 4 votes on the Supreme Court to uphold a law like this. And they think instead that the way to get rid of Roe is a much more sort of slow, incremental approach that focuses on later abortions and builds over the course of years to a direct attack on Roe. And they think that pushing so fast and so hard might actually backfire and result in something that would either accomplish nothing or maybe even bring Justice Roberts over to the side of upholding Roe. So I think it's pretty much anybody's guess, because there is this divide within the anti-abortion movement, and both sides are, I think, lobbying legislators to come over to their point of view.
So, Dr. Conte, if there are more of these bills, what do you see as the impact on the medical community?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, there are certain states that we just saw out of New York with the New York Reproductive Health Act, Virginia, California. There are states that will continue to uphold Roe, even if it falls, or essentially uphold the same laws, the same message. But there are states that won't. And there are several states that are passing what we're calling trigger laws, which means that essentially when Roe falls, their states will not uphold those privileges for women as well. And I think that the closing message that I want to say, that I always tell people, is that 1 in 4 women will have an abortion during their reproductive life, which means that if you think you don't know someone who's had an abortion, you're very likely wrong, and it's probably just that they haven't told you. The other thing is that the majority of people who have abortions are already mothers. And so I think when you take these two things together, you realize that abortion is, 1, incredibly common, and 2, likely defies the stereotypes that you have about it. So if we can change the framework about how we look at abortion and look at it in more of a compassionate light, then potentially we can realize that this is normal, safe, and should be legal healthcare.
And doctor, I just want to ask you, if these laws go into effect, what options will women have who still want to terminate pregnancies in these states?
It's a tough question, because some states, like Georgia, have said that potentially they would criminalize people if they decided to leave the state and have an abortion elsewhere, you know, if they were able to prove that. But one of the things that we are looking more into, and I just actually wrote an article in Self magazine about this, is self-induced or self-managed abortions, or abortions outside of the healthcare system. We know that this is already happening, especially in other parts of the country, or other parts of the world, but also in America. And there are services that are sourcing these medications online or in other avenues. The FDA is still pretty clear that this is not something they recommend, and that you can't really vouch for the safety of these medications. But we do know that as these laws continue to become more prevalent, this is undoubtedly going to be an avenue that women seek.
Dr. Jennifer Conte is a professor of gynecology at Stanford University, and Mary Ziegler is a law professor at Florida State University. Thanks to you both for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Sure. The civil war in Syria started more than 8 years ago with the Arab Spring, when civilians took to the streets to protest the authoritarian regime of President Bashar al-Assad. In response, Assad and his government started imprisoning and torturing the people who stood up to the regime, crushing that opposition and creating a culture of fear that contributed to the mass exodus of refugees. The horrific program continues today.
There are at least 127,000 people still inside or missing from that system. But that's an undercount, because that's only the cases which were specifically documented to the organization that keeps the closest track of these numbers.
Anne Bernard is the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a reporter for the New York Times, where she was the Beirut Bureau Chief from 2012 to 2018. And she has a new piece in the Times that extensively details the torture of civilians by the Assad regime.
I haven't heard anyone describe going into these torture prisons without being tortured. There's a thing called reception, where on the moment they arrive in a certain one of the hundreds of facilities, there's a systematic beating just on arrival. And then it sort of goes downhill from there, both in terms of specific torture methods under interrogation that go from basic to really baroque and sadistic, to just a level of neglect that UN investigators have labeled the crime against humanity of extermination, because so many people die simply from the untreated injuries, lack of food, lack of hygiene, etc.
Let's be clear that this program that you're describing targeted civilians. What impact did that have in this war, Anne?
It played a critical role in the ability of President Assad to overcome a mass movement of political protests against his rule. This was a movement that began with largely peaceful street protests, and this system existed before, and it was actually one of the reasons that people went in the street to protest. But it also was a tool for suppressing those protests, raising the costs unbearably high for people that participated in them, because merely participating in a protest or even liking a Facebook post about a protest could land you into this system. And for women, there was this extra price, and men as well, actually. Sexual abuse of men was also rampant, is also rampant inside. But this raised the price, especially for women, because of the double punishment, whereby in a conservative society, there's a stigma for anyone who was in the prison because of the assumption that they've been sexually abused or raped.
There are 5 million Syrian refugees still in Europe and the Middle East. Is this system affecting those folks? Or what are the tentacles of this, if you will? Yeah.
So this system has many tentacles that reach out into the larger world. It's not just a story about Syria. So, for instance, one of the main reasons that the 5 million refugees who are outside of Syria do not want to go home is because they fear for their security. And there are many elements of insecurity in the prospect of returning to Syria right now. But one of the main ones for a lot of people is the threat of being sucked into this system, even just because of the town they're from, or because they avoided army service, or because they are related to someone who may have once protested. There are already cases of people that have taken the chance to return or who remained inside Syria and took what the government called reconciliation deals, that you can come out of a rebel-held area and rejoin the government's world, so to speak, and you're supposed to be okay. But there are numbers of documented cases of people getting sucked into the system after accepting one of those deals. So this is an ongoing problem for the refugee crisis. And, of course, it also has this larger meaning, which is that we're in a moment in the world right now where there's a growing authoritarian wave. And the fear of refugees, the fear of terrorism, which is often conflated with refugees, even though they're actually the ones trying to escape terrorism, both the violence of their government and the violence of militants, this fear of refugees has boosted the right wing in many countries, and it's affecting politics, it's affecting international organizations and the ability of countries to agree on things as important as the meaning of Europe or how to respond to humanitarian crises. And at the same time, the fact that a leader can get away with this kind of mass atrocity using the machinery of the state to carry that out and essentially win by that means, creates this very dangerous example for other authoritarian leaders who might say, well, I should get a system like that or expand the one I already have because it works.
The frustrating thing when you talk about, and beyond frustrating, I mean, I think the heartbreaking part of this is whether or not this regime will ultimately be held responsible for these deaths.
That is one of the most painful aspects, as you said, but it's also an aspect where there is a tiny bit of hope in the sense that there are efforts to seek justice and accountability. Now, there won't be any kind of Syrian transitional justice process anytime soon, since Assad remains in power with no sign of reforms on the horizon. But Syrians are taking this into their own hands. Syrian human rights lawyers themselves, who are themselves, many of them, survivors of this torture, are working with European lawyers to launch cases in countries in Europe which have something called universal jurisdiction, where they can, the law provides the opportunity to try war crimes even if they haven't happened in that country, if they've happened to someone who's now in that country, or if a perpetrator is in the country. So there are cases now in Germany, France, and other European countries that are seeking to bring these details to court. They've won arrest warrants for some top security officials who are still sitting in Syria. Now, those people aren't going to actually be arrested and hauled into court, but it is a way to keep this on the table, to keep it in the public eye, to keep it in front of governments who may be thinking about normalizing with this system, and just a way to keep new information coming out and being archived, including documents from the government that have been smuggled out. There are, with 127,000 people at a minimum still missing in this system, each of those people has a large family. So we're talking about millions of Syrians who have been affected by this and may be in limbo because of a missing family member that they are not really even going to be allowed to speak of publicly.
And Bernard is the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a reporter at the New York Times, where she was the Beirut Bureau Chief from 2012 to 2018. Anne, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you, Tanzina.
You can find a link to Anne Bernard's full story in the Times at thetakeaway.org. The Trump administration is continuing its efforts to make the asylum process at the southern border more difficult. For people requesting asylum, the first step is a credible fear interview with the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service official. Now, the Department of Homeland Security will be deploying Customs and Border Protection officers to conduct some credible fear interviews. Immigration advocates worry the change means asylum seekers will be less likely to pass their interview. This comes on the heels of a federal appeals court ruling that the Trump administration can continue to send asylum seekers to Mexico while they wait for their day in court. Helping us to make sense of this entire process is Dara Lynn, senior correspondent at Vox covering immigration. Dara, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, with this reported change to have CBP officers conducting credible fear interviews, are they going to be replacing asylum officers or supplementing?
Well, for now, at least, the plan is to have them supplement. Of course, this is such a radical break from what the Division of Labor has been that there is a fear that this is kind of some test pilot for, you know, having them ultimately replace them entirely. What's happening is right now, a team of about 10 Border Patrol officers is being trained in how to do credible fear interviews, what that looks like. There's no set timetable for when they're going to be in the field, but we know that they are going to be, you know, in theory, supervised by the same people who supervise asylum officers for at least the first period of time, and then they're going to be conducting interviews on their own. There's only going to be, I think there are plans for about 50 Border Patrol officers to get trained in this by the end of the summer, so that's not a whole lot of people given the number of people coming in and seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. So it's right now, it wouldn't be enough to fully replace asylum officers, but asylum officers themselves are kind of wondering, well, if the problem is that there aren't enough of us, why isn't the move to
hire more asylum officers rather than to have a border patrol that the Trump administration is also saying is extremely stretched thin and needs to be shifting its own resources around to do its own job.
And we know that immigration advocates are concerned about this policy change. Dara, why is that?
The thinking behind a credible fear interview is supposed to be that it is non-combative, that it is a way for people who are often traumatized, who have gone through a very difficult journey, to talk about what they've experienced in a way that is, you know, as open and supportive as possible so that they can get all the facts correct. And that it's understood that an asylum seeker doesn't necessarily know the right, you know, phrases in asylum law to use, that it's the job of the asylum officer to kind of translate that into a legal context. Customs and Border Protection officers, you know, that's not part of their job description as it exists right now. When they are interviewing asylum seekers to kind of fill out, you know, the initial paperwork, they often do take a combative approach. You know, they're trained in interrogation in a lot of cases. They're not trained to do these kind of non-confrontational interviews. And the Trump administration has stopped saying, initially they were kind of letting it be known in early reports that the point of this was to have fewer people pass their screening interviews. And then they realized that that was creating a massive litigation risk because the standard for an initial screening interview is supposed to be deliberately low because the point is to avoid sending people back and violating international law. You know, it's to avoid false negatives rather than false positives. But they've stopped saying that. They're now kind of saying that it's, you know, the best way to use the resources, that it's a way to deal with this backlog. But everybody who's looking at it assumes that the root of this is that the White House feels that too many people are passing their screening interviews and has lost faith in USCIS agents to change the way they do it.
Dara, this is all happening in the context of the Remain in Mexico policy. You've been reporting extensively on this issue. What have we seen so far, and where does it stand today?
The policy, which initially was this very limited, you know, a couple of dozen people were getting returned a day at this one port of entry in San Diego, has now spread across the border so that, you know, we're now talking about as many as hundreds of people a week. A few thousand have been returned so far. And the way that this works is people are either they are apprehended by Border Patrol agents after arriving in the U.S., crossing between ports of entry, committing the misdemeanor of illegal entry, or they present themselves at ports of entry for asylum. And when they're initially processed, they are then given a court date and sent back to Mexico to wait for that court date. And on the day of their court hearing, they're escorted back into the U.S., given the hearing, and then escorted back to Mexico. The logic here is that if people are going to, you know, abscond into the U.S. instead of showing up for their court hearings, they can't do that if they're not in the U.S. But it's created a lot of confusion, a lot of questions about whether they're getting adequate representation, and some substantial questions about whether the Trump administration is being honest with the public and with the courts about the way it's being implemented.
You also wrote a story about where you've interviewed asylum officers who are sending people to Mexico under this policy. What have they been telling you?
The asylum officers who are involved here, there's an additional kind of screening level that is triggered if somebody tells a Border Patrol agent, don't send me back to Mexico, I'm afraid of going back there. Then they're given an interview with an asylum officer, but that's a much higher standard that they have to pass to avoid getting sent back than the credible fear standard that we were talking about earlier. So the asylum officers that I talked to said they weren't given adequate training in this new standard. In some cases, people had to do interviews without having been trained in the new standard at all. And they were saying that the way that standard is being implemented, it makes it in practice exceedingly difficult, nearly impossible for somebody to successfully establish that they would in fact be in danger and to avoid getting sent back to Mexico under this policy. And, you know, some of the stories that I heard were cases coming back from headquarters saying this, we don't think this meets the standard. You need to change the way you find this. You know, heard about cases in which the supervisor or somebody above the supervisor said, well, they didn't say explicitly enough that they were being persecuted on this basis, or the person they said was persecuting them didn't explicitly name, oh, I'm doing this because you're a member of XYZ group. So the way that they kind of put all these together, they feel that they're being asked to do something that they very much worry is inconsistent with international law and with their humanitarian obligations. And so even though asylum officers are generally very head down civil servants, people who are very reluctant to talk to press, they, as a matter of a labor issue, actually through their union, came and spoke to me and kind of raised some alarms and said, we don't know how much longer we can do this personally, in a moral sense.
And do you expect that that will change?
As the policy has expanded, some of the things that the asylum officers raised with me about, like the initial secrecy with which the program was being rolled out, have been addressed a little bit. But I think that this is kind of happening to the asylum corps at the same time that they're looking at Border Patrol being sent to do their jobs, at the same time that they are getting new training in credible fear interviews that is asking them to take a more confrontational approach and getting a little less sensitive toward the trauma that asylum seekers have often undergone. So there's a general sense, and, you know, this is, I think a lot of civil servants under the Trump administration are worried about what they're being asked to do or feel that they're no longer being allowed to do the job that they signed up for. It's something that you actually also heard from ICE officers under the Obama administration, right? There was a lot of, we are not being allowed to do our jobs because the White House wants to control the way we enforce the law. It's kind of a flip side of that that you're hearing now from the asylum corps.
Dara Lind is a senior correspondent at Vox covering immigration. Dara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you're one of the 211 million people in the United States who play video games, chances are you've come across something called a loot box, a virtual box filled with add-ons like weapons or a new outfit that you can get at a price. By the year 2022, loot boxes are expected to be a $50 billion industry. And that is a lot of loot, and it's drawing the attention of federal regulators. Here's Senator Maggie Hassan, a Democrat from New Hampshire, explaining loot boxes to members of the Federal Trade Commission at a hearing back in November.
Specifically, we discussed loot boxes, which allow in-game purchases with real currency for surprise winnings, and most of you agreed that this is an area that could use additional oversight by the FTC. Loot boxes are now endemic in the video game industry and are present in everything from casual smartphone games to the newest high-budget video game releases.
In addition to kids racking up expensive bills on their parents' credit cards, there's a growing body of evidence that suggests that these digital products are linked to problem gambling. It's a major concern considering the immense appeal video games hold over children.
Children may be particularly susceptible to engaging with these in-game purchases, which are often considered integral components of video games.
The FTC has promised to investigate the matter, but now another lawmaker is getting involved. Last week, freshman Senator Josh Hawley, a Republican from Missouri, proposed legislation that would ban video game makers from selling loot boxes to minors. Joining us now for more on this story is McKenna Kelly, a policy reporter for The Verge. McKenna, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
McKenna, if I'm playing a video game, right, and generally speaking, it's not a new concept to be able to buy something within the game. What makes these boxes different is that we don't know what we're buying.
Yeah, so you don't know what you're buying. This is something that's been happening for maybe a decade now in mobile games, things that you can buy on your phone for games that are normally pretty free. But they've moved into AAA studio big budget games now. And basically, you're already paying $60 for the game. And then all of a sudden, they're asking you to buy these loot boxes with randomized things in them for more.
And do we know about how much on average whatever it is costs?
So one game that I play on my phone, I'm a really big fan of Nintendo's Animal Crossing franchise. That I can pay like a couple dollars, like $1 or $2, and I can get an item in that. But sometimes it ranks up, right? So it could be anywhere between like $1 and $5. It's mostly pocket change, but that's what makes them kind of addicting, right? So if you pay $1 and you don't get what you wanted, you can pay another dollar, and then all of a sudden you've spent $15-$20 in some cases. To the people that I've spoken to, they've spent hundreds and thousands of dollars because they just already have issues with gambling or impulse control. Now, it's hard to say if that is just a side effect of a different issue that they're having, whether that be some kind of anxiety or depression. At this point, it's really difficult to say whether or not it's gambling. Now, a lot of people say that it could be, but a big problem is that these companies have all the data, and it's proprietary data on who's spending how much money. So it's difficult for outside researchers to look into this and do an unbiased, independent review on whether these behaviors look like and resemble gambling.
Now, there's a bigger component to this, which is if that's my money, I know what the money is being spent on, right? But there are concerns about children buying these loot boxes. Tell us about those.
With children, of course, children just don't have their prefrontal cortex developed, right? They don't have the capability to really stop in some cases. And if you have your parents' credit card on your iPad, on your Xbox account, on your Nintendo Switch account, and you're just able to make these small purchases, you're just going to do them, right? And then it's even more difficult in some cases for parents when they get that bill to even get a refund, because those items that the children have already bought have already been used. It's not something that's easy, you know, to go back to the store and return.
There is legislation from Senator Josh Hawley. What is it proposing?
Josh Hawley, he's a freshman senator, right? And he has been looking into children's issues online. So he has a bill with Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts where they want to have better privacy protections for children online. Now he's kind of moving into video games. And so this bill would basically ban the sale of loot boxes to anyone under the age of 18. And it would also ban them in children's games entirely. And then if this developer were to find out that a child was buying a loot box from them, they could face severe penalties from the Federal Trade Commission. Also, what the bill does is it bans pay-to-win mechanics. So those mechanics where you have to buy a loot box, buy a specific item in order to get further in the game, it would ban pay-to-win games that are targeted to children as well.
What about the industry itself, the video game industry? I mean, this is a billion-dollar industry, or billions of dollars annually. What are they saying about this? I imagine they're probably not very happy about the proposed legislation.
Right. So the Entertainment Software Association is the largest trade association for the video game industry, right? So if you go and you try to talk to Blizzard, or if you go and talk to Electronic Arts, EA, and you try to talk to these people at these companies, they're really, really quiet on loot boxes. And the ESA basically does all the talking for them. Back in the 90s, ESA started the ESRB, which is the ratings board for video games, after there was a threat from lawmakers in Congress to regulate video games based on them being too violent or not being suitable for children. So the industry has had a similar reaction before where they've decided to self-regulate in order to get ahead of imposed legislation from lawmakers and the government. So we're not really seeing that right now. The ESA itself has really been fighting back on this idea that loot boxes are gambling, that loot boxes are bad for kids. So they're still in this aggressive lobbying space, and they really aren't taking a step forward to even look at themselves and self-regulate at this point.
And are there bigger systemic issues here other than loot boxes specifically that are really drawing concern?
So the microtransactions, that's just something that even aside from children, people are really not happy about. So there was a video game that came out in late 2017. It was Star Wars Battlefront 2. It was a big blockbuster game that a lot of people were really excited to play. Now, the introduction of loot boxes in that game basically ruined the gameplay for a ton of people. And for a lot of the community, the gaming community, they're just upset and they feel like these developers are being incredibly greedy. I know whenever I write about loot boxes, there's always comments on it like, thank God there's this bill. Thank God something's happening. And this is just regular people, right? It's not just children. So the industry, a lot of people are really upset that the industry just might be being too greedy here.
McKenna Kelly is a policy reporter for The Verge. McKenna, thank you.
Hey, thanks so much.
And we reached out to the Entertainment Software Association for comment on Senator Hawley's proposed legislation. They gave us a statement from the group's acting president and CEO that said, quote, "We look forward to sharing with the senator the tools and information the industry already provides that keeps the control of in-game spending in parents' hands."
A This is Walton from Seattle. It's easy enough to prevent my kids from in-game purchasing. It's much harder to control my own impulses.
This is Erin Woolen from Ohio County, Kentucky. I turn off data for all my kids' games. If it needs internet, they can't play it. And we never, ever in-app purchase anything.
This is David from Miami, Florida. My son accidentally racked up two $500 bills over the course of weeks, and I had to remove my credit card from the gaming system to stop these accidents.
Parents of gamers, have you had issues with your kids buying loot boxes or making in-game purchases without your permission? Join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or tweet us at The Takeaway. That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.